Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The scenes caught by television cameras are still hard to comprehend, even as they have become familiar to us since Saturday. White supremacist demonstrators gathered openly in Charlottesville, Virginia, bearing Confederate flags and even Nazi armbands to protest the planned removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. A 20-year-old man named James Alex Fields was arrested at the scene and charged with second-degree murder for plowing a Dodge Charger into the crowd of counter-protesters and killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer. 19 other people were injured. President Trump's initial remarks condemned the display of hatred, bigotry, and violence, in his words, on many sides. His initial refusal to specifically condemn white supremacy sparked widespread criticism from both Republican and Democratic lawmakers. That led to a follow-up statement by the president today, during which he called out by name the KKK, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists. Later in the hour, we will speak with Emory Professor Carol Anderson, an expert in the phenomenon of white rage. First, though, an update on the story from Charlottesville. We have Sandy Hausman, who is the Charlottesville Bureau Chief for Radio IQ and WVTF. Sandy, welcome to Think.
Thanks.
How concerned were authorities in Charlottesville in the lead up to this weekend's events that there might be trouble at this demonstration?
I think they were very concerned. They were monitoring chatter online, and they knew that there might very well be trouble. We had a very large presence of state police here. But we talked with local police the day before the rally, and they seemed very uncertain of how many people were coming and what might happen. And in fact, as you may know, there was a march across the University of Virginia campus Friday night, which no one expected. These guys lit up tiki torches and marched and chanted, and they were confronted by people who disagreed with them, and there were fights, but that all, you know, happened spontaneously.
I know that during the daytime protests, there were a lot of demonstrators carrying weapons, and we should note that Virginia is an open carry state. Were those weapons evident in the Friday night demonstration as well?
I was not actually there Friday night. Mm-hmm. I've not heard that. I have heard that some members of that party used their tiki torches as weapons, that when they got into fights with those who opposed them, they were swinging burning sticks.
We know that the man arrested for the murder of Heather Heyer, who was a counter-demonstrator, the man arrested for that murder was from Ohio. Is it possible to know how many folks were local to Charlottesville and how many came from out of town to either demonstrate or counter-demonstrate?
You know, this whole movement has been going on for a while. It started many months ago with this fellow, Jason Kessler, who's a local blogger and a white supremacist. He wanted to remove the only African-American on Charlottesville City Council because of some racist tweets that he had sent some years ago, for which he has apologized. And so we were kind of expecting this kind of thing, but not from the locals. Jason we know about, and there are some other people who follow him, and they have been sort of haunting Charlottesville's downtown mall over the months and picking fights, if you will. But my impression is that a lot of people came from out of this area and possibly from out of state. And that was also true of the counter protesters. We had many here from New York, from Boston, from Washington, D.C., and Richmond.
In terms of background on the decision that catalyzed this particular demonstration, how long had the statue of Robert E. Lee anchored Lee Park, and how unanimous were the calls to have it removed?
I don't actually know the numbers. It's been there for quite a long time, probably since the 1930s, I would guess. Mm-hmm. And no, there is not unanimity in this community. In fact, I talked to a couple of African-American guys yesterday, and they were saying they don't really care about the statue. You know, it's not really important to them. And the mayor, for example, when the vote was taken, did not think that the statue should be removed, but instead thought that some informative signage about the history of the South and of slavery and racism ought to be erected to kind of put that statue in context. You know, one of the great fears of the white supremacists is that if we remove the statue of General Lee, do we then have to take down the statue of Thomas Jefferson, who also owned slaves?
Yeah, these debates in many parts of the country are part of the concern on the part of people who don't want statues like this removed is that these are efforts to erase history is what some people are concerned about.
Right, that's what they say. And in fact, they are now being referred to as Southern heritage activists, people who want to keep that memory of the pre-Civil War South alive.
I went online and discovered that Emancipation Park, which is the place where the statue is located, was dedicated in 1917. So this was not an immediate response, at least the park wasn't, to the Civil War. But it does lie on something called the Virginia Civil War Trail. Virginia takes its Civil War history seriously.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, there are those who would tell you that the Civil War is still being fought here in Virginia. But yeah, we have lots of guys who enjoy reenacting battles and many battlefields that have been preserved here. And it's a big part of the curriculum in schools. So yeah, it's very much a part of this culture.
So please jump in and correct my Googling if I have something wrong here. What I found about the demographics of the city is that the population of Charlottesville is about 71% white, about 20% black, which is to say a little bit blacker than the country in general. The next most significant minority is the Asian population at about 7%. What can you tell us, Sandy, about the state of racial harmony or discord in Charlottesville on an ordinary day? How well do folks get along?
You know, my son came to visit me from Chicago here a few months back, and he said, where is the black community? Okay. It was just not evident to him. So I would say that the city remains very much segregated, and there are still bad feelings between the black community and the University of Virginia. The university's tried very hard to make amends for a past in which slaves helped to build the university, but I would say that the black community is still very wary of mixing with whites here. And there is certainly, if you look at the police department and what goes on, one could make the case that police, for example, are stopping and frisking African Americans more so than whites. So, yeah, I would say that there's not a great record here as far as racial harmony. But on the other hand, I think people are trying very hard to make change.
That is
part of the renaming of Lee Park, mm-hmm. calling it Emancipation Park. That was one of the few unanimous votes by city council, and part of the discussion about why the statue should go.
Charlottesville is in a county that saw 59% of voters cast ballots for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Is that right, compared with about 34% for President Trump?
Yes, that mm-hmm. sounds right.
So how would you describe the political climate of the city?
The city itself is very, very blue. The university is here, obviously, and there are lots of trendy neighborhoods and many people who've moved here from out of state, quite frankly. I think after 9/11, a lot of New Yorkers discovered Virginia. Hmm. So, yeah, you know, it tends to be a very liberal pocket. People call it the People's Republic of Charlottesville. But it's not an activist city. You don't see a lot of radical politics. What you do see is a lot of well-meaning people who would probably describe themselves as liberals.
Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, it's interesting to note that because a city thinks of itself as liberal doesn't mean that it is untroubled by racial divisions or, at the very least, some segregation from one community to the next.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think Charlottesville is increasingly aware of that. I think, again, that people are well-meaning and they want to have a good relationship with the black community here. They're working on it.
There were also two state troopers killed this weekend in a helicopter crash that happened when they were performing surveillance on the rallies. Is there any information on what might have caused that chopper to go down?
I've not heard a thing.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay. This has got to be stunning, first of all, for these terrible events to happen, and then for people in Charlottesville to be coping with the sudden glare of national attention on the city. Can you talk about how people are dealing?
Oh, I would say that most people in Charlottesville are very unhappy, very unhappy. We feel targeted, to be perfectly honest, and unfairly so. We want these white supremacists to go away, the neo-Nazis to get out of town. I think the governor expressed it very well when he just said, go home, you're not wanted here. And they're especially angry with Jason Kessler, the man who organized the rally. Yesterday, he tried to hold a news conference, and the public showed up. This was not something I expected. I skated in with my tape recorder at the last minute, thinking I would pop it onto the podium, and there was a huge crowd already chanting at him. And he tried to speak. He said, you know, he did not condone things that hurt people. And you could not hear him for the crowd chanting. And so I knelt down. I had my microphone up trying to record him. And the crowd started moving in. You know, they started surrounding him and somebody started shouting in his face. And the next thing I knew, he was running away and the crowd was chasing him. It was like a mob scene. Whether he would have actually been hurt had he been caught, I don't know. State police were nearby and gave him shelter. So people are very angry. And these are not people who are prone to anger, honestly. This is, everybody's pretty dismayed at being targeted in this way, at being associated with this sort of thing. I think Charlottesville considers itself a very mannerly place. Mm-hmm. It's Virginia, after all. And, of course, with the university here, we like to think that we're educated and rational, and we love Mr. Jefferson even to this day. And so this is kind of heartbreaking. That's the word the mayor used. It's heartbreaking.
Is Thomas Jefferson a controversial figure there in Charlottesville? Because, of course, I know he's a favorite son of the state of Virginia. Sometimes when people talk about removing Civil War monuments, they say, well, if we are going to take these down, then we cannot honor Thomas Jefferson as a slaveholder.
Right. That is a big concern of the people who are protesting the removal of the statue. I would say Jefferson's well-loved here. Every few months, I get another book about Thomas Jefferson written by somebody who's here. He's much admired, and I think he is, for the most part, forgiven for being a man of his times in some ways. I mean, you know, history may look back on us driving gas-guzzling cars and condemn us. Fair enough. Times have changed. And Jefferson himself was, to some extent, conflicted, obviously. You know, he had this relationship with Sally Hemings. Monticello readily admits that. Monticello was his home, you know, and a big tourist attraction, and they now give a slave tour of the plantation, explaining to people what life was like there. And so I think we've certainly made our peace with Jefferson having owned slaves.
Sandy, this is an interesting era in which to cover something like racial violence and unrest because, you mentioned going to these events with your tape recorder in hand, but some of what happens now is also taking place online. So can you talk a little bit about how you may be using websites and things to understand the ideas of the groups that you are covering?
Absolutely. I finally made peace with Twitter because it's essential for reporters. You simply have to be there to follow something that's evolving as quickly as the situation was on Saturday and Sunday, and more critically to provide context. For example, the man who has been charged with murder for running his car into the crowd, we don't know much about him, but he has a Facebook page, and his Facebook page suggests that he admired Donald Trump very much. And he also admired Adolf Hitler. So, yes, to the extent that there's lots of information out there now that wasn't there before, we have to stay on social media. And, of course, as I say, things are evolving quickly. So Saturday was just mad. I was shuttling back and forth from the protest to the studio and could barely keep up.
I know that it's hard to generalize for 40-some thousand people, but I wonder if you can talk about the response that you've heard from people to the president's comments to what's happened this weekend.
Well, this is a city that's not very fond of Donald Trump. I think we could fairly say that. He does not have a lot of support here. In the county, perhaps. The county's more rural and probably more traditional, and certainly there are more registered Republicans in Albemarle County. But here in Charlottesville, if you're a Democrat, you're in. And yeah, I think, I don't know.
All right, we'll leave it there. Sandy Hausman is Charlottesville Bureau Chief for Radio IQ and WVTF. Sandy, our thoughts are with you in Charlottesville. Thanks very much for making time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, scholar Carol Anderson on the phenomenon of white rage in America and the role it's played in recent displays of white nationalism. Think returns in 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Support for the Think podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Even as more facts emerge about the weekend of white nationalist demonstrations and terrorism in Charlottesville, many Americans are struggling to understand why people would travel from all over the country to protest the removal of a monument to Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Carol Anderson joins us to talk about the toxic phenomenon of white rage, which she notes has been a depressingly predictable and brutal response to Black progress throughout American history. Carol Anderson is Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor and Chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University. She published an essay in The Guardian yesterday about what she calls the drug of white supremacy. And last year, she published a book called White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Carol, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I want to start by listening to President Trump's two comments in response to this event. This first is from Saturday.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country. Not Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. It's been going on for a long, long time. It has no place in America. What is vital now is a swift restoration of law and order and the protection of innocent lives.
Many people were disappointed by that condemnation, implicating people on many sides of this issue rather than white supremacists specifically. Today, the president's made another statement.
Racism is evil. And those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. We are a nation founded on the truth that all of us are created equal.
Why, Carol Anderson, do you think it took the president more than 2 days to be very specific about the problem here?
Because he had to have his staff convince him that there was a problem. And they had to convince him long and hard that there was a problem. I saw where Bill Kristol had said, you know, his staff came at him early saying, you need to make a strong statement, and he absolutely refused. Then he issued something that came out from some spokesperson saying, well, yeah, of course, it's, you know, Nazis are bad. But for him to be able to say it, it didn't emanate from a place where it was real and where he understood it, because he has stoked this. He has given a space, a legitimate above ground space for this kind of hatred and violence. You think about how he launched his campaign with the birther attacks, demanding to see President Barack Obama's birth certificate to prove that he was an American. That on its face is so vile. Then the, you know, Mexicans are rapists and they are criminals. I'm sure there are some good ones who come here, as he said, as a kind of flip aside. But that gives a sense that what all of them are, or his attack on Judge Curiel, that here was a judge who couldn't possibly be impartial because, you know, he's Mexican. So he has trolled in this ground for a while. You know, the violence that was happening at his campaign stops, his campaign rallies, where he's encouraging the people who are there to beat up on Black people, and that he's going to, you know, go ahead, hit them hard. I'll pay your legal fees. So all of this is who he is, and it's been who he is for a long time.
You note that what happened this weekend is exactly what many people feared a Trump presidency would unleash. Indeed, you and I talked about this almost exactly a year ago.
Yes.
What does the Trump administration represent to white supremacists?
To me, it represents for them a reclamation project, that he's reclaiming the White House from a usurper, that he's reclaiming white's rightful place in America, that he's reclaiming the power that needs to be there to ensure that this is a nation where the resources flow overwhelmingly to whites. When you look at the kinds of policies, because, you know, in White Rage, what I really talk about is that, yes, there's the violence, but when we're so focused in on the violence, we miss the policies that undergird that violence, that sanction that violence, and the policies that do more damage than the violence itself. And that is what we're seeing with Muslim travel bans, what we're seeing with a massive arrest and deportation of immigrants, what we're seeing with the call to privatize prisons, what we're seeing with the call to for law and order and criminalization of marijuana and restarting the war on drugs. All of these things are designed to basically put African Americans and Latinos back in their place so that these people are not talking about and fighting for their voting rights, are not fighting for and talking about their employment rights, that they're not talking about their educational rights, that they are labor without rights.
Do white supremacists believe there is some material benefit to be derived from keeping people of color as a permanent underclass, or are they looking, do you think, to soothe some kind of emotional or psychological wound by declaring other people inferior?
Yes.
Yes to both.
So, yes, you know. Mm-hmm. So what you have is on one hand, when you think about it, so this is the thing, let's take the Confederacy, mm-hmm. Lord, take it, is that, you know, you get this language about it is about our heritage, and it sounds so, and how many times have we watched some show and they talk about Southern charm, and you know, and they show an old plantation and they as Southern charm. And so that is that nostalgia, that longing for the good old days, and that is an emotional feel. Now, underneath all of that is slavery. There is the buying, the selling, the breeding of human beings. And slavery was such an integral part, not just of the Southern economy, but of the American economy, that at the start of the Civil War, slavery accounted for 80% of the nation's gross domestic product. Hmm. And so the economic benefits of having people do labor and not having to compensate them, the benefit of having labor people that become property. The Dinah Rama Berry has written a fabulous, beautiful book where she is actually looking at the value, the pound of flesh, as it were, the cost for at all of these auctions and how that helps build wealth. And so the economic component of that is absolutely essential. That's that longing for the Confederacy, where we see it. And so let me take another case. In, I believe it was Detroit in the 1980s, out of work auto workers beat an Asian American man to death, Vincent Chin. They beat him to death with a baseball bat, because they were out of work and Toyota and Datsun at the time, we now know as Nissan, were doing really well. So they were like, you are taking our jobs. Hmm. And in beating him to death, and Vincent Chin was not Japanese, but they weren't making that distinction. They saw an Asian man must be Japanese. This Japanese man who, what, he doesn't own Toyota, he doesn't own Nissan, but they saw him as the enemy taking our jobs. And in killing him, the judge said, I see how you could, you know, I feel your angst. And they got off with probation for murder.
You've written, for every action of African-American advancement, there's a reaction, a backlash. Every time I ask this question, it makes, you know, people laugh like I'm asking it flippantly, and I'm really not. What do white Americans have to be so angry about? What do they feel like they are losing?
Oh, my. That is a great, great question. And I think it has to do with a sense of status. But it's a very myopic sense, you know, and I talked about that. I did an op-ed in The New York Times, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before, where I talked about how white resentment is selfish and myopic. Because what it doesn't understand consistently over time, and this is one of the issues that I was driving home in White Rage, is that when the nation is thriving, whites are thriving too. But for instance, we spent $1 trillion on the war on drugs. $1 trillion. And we know it doesn't work. If we had actually used those funds to invest in our people instead of incarcerate them, we would be looking at a very different kind of nation right now. But what that did, what the war on drugs did, was it undercut many of the advancements of the civil rights movement so that you have, for instance, massive felony disfranchisement. So if you're a felon, you don't get to vote. And three states have that as permanent felony disfranchisement. Those sorts of things. It limits your access to education. It limits your access to housing. Is this really what we should be doing, want to be doing? But that's what we did in terms of this sense that the pie was shrinking and I couldn't get mine. Somebody was going to take my job. Somebody was going to take my status. Somebody was going to move into my neighborhood and my property values were going to go down. Somebody was going to get in my slot into my college.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Carol Anderson, who chairs the African American Studies Department at Emory University and is author of a book called White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Carol, I just want to get this out there before we move on, because I think there may be white people listening to our conversation who feel unfairly lumped in with white supremacists based solely on the color of their skin. They don't feel like they've contributed to this way of thinking. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that sensitivity, and is there a way to channel it into something constructive?
And I think we're seeing that right now, actually. When I give talks, I say the problem is not white people. The problem is white supremacy. And if we are very clear about that, then we're able to have the conversation. And we're seeing it, for instance, yesterday in those rallies across the nation, where you had, I mean, as I'm looking at the pictures from all over the place, I'm seeing whites pouring out into the streets because they do not want to be in a nation where white supremacy is the operating principle. That is powerful. This is not about all whites. Whites have to have the conversation. Whites have to get in there as allies fighting this thing that keeps us from being as fantastic as we can be. So this isn't about all whites. This is about white supremacy and how it operates and how we have to fight it, particularly in terms of those policies like voter suppression.
Does white supremacy, though, benefit all whites, even those who don't actively participate in it?
Yes, it does. And that's why having whites stand up and say, no, I don't want this, is absolutely essential. It is powerful. It is what must be done if we are to survive.
Carol, it's hard not to notice, looking at the very disturbing photographs, that the overwhelming majority of these demonstrators brandishing Confederate flags and torches and swastikas mm-hmm. are male. Mm-hmm. Does that mean white supremacy runs deeper among white men, or simply that men are more emboldened maybe to openly display their opinion than women?
I think that it means that there were men who are out there in the street doing that, but that there are women who are firmly in white supremacy's corner and wrapped up in it and swaddled in it as well. Part of that, for instance, is when you think about Trump's election and how 53% of white women voted for him. And, you know, this is a man who had demonstrated virtually every odious, repugnant characteristic that we raise our children not to have. So he was an admitted serial sexual assaulter. He called for the death penalty for five young men, four African American, one Latino, for a rape that turned out that they were innocent of. And at the time, the death penalty for rape had been found unconstitutional because it had been used overwhelmingly against black men. This is a man who had refused to rent apartments to African Americans. So he had demonstrated his racism and his sexism early on and consistently. And he promised to make America white again. And that was enough for 53% of white women to vote for him.
Carol Anderson is my guest. She's Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor and Chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University. We're talking to her today about white rage. This is what fueled, she says, the demonstrations that we saw this weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. It's also the title of a book she published last year, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We'll take some calls when we come back. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send us a message on Twitter @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Professor Carol Anderson of Emory University. She's author of a book called White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Carol, in this piece that you wrote yesterday for The Guardian, you characterize white supremacy as a reality-warping drug that has millions of Americans hooked. Who is susceptible to getting hooked on this drug?
I think it is, there are those who aren't paying attention to the history of this nation, who aren't paying attention to the reality of this nation, and those who feel entitled and aggrieved simultaneously. It is a way that makes them feel powerful, that makes them feel special, that makes them feel inherently better than anybody or anything else. That's who really becomes susceptible to the drug of white supremacy.
I don't know if this is even a question that you can answer, but
probably not.
Well, you know, you think about this question, and other scholars that we've spoken to on the show have talked about the fact that many Americans of color, Latinos and African Americans in particular, can look at previous generations and see that they're doing at least marginally better economically, socially, than their parents and grandparents before them. Many working class white Americans don't feel that way. But why is it that we classify ourselves that way? Why is it that we don't say, you know, 30-year-old women are doing better, and I'm happy that it, you know what I mean? Like, why is race where we divide?
Race is embedded into the way that this nation was actually founded. Mm-hmm. And so it is one of the pillars upon this nation. I mean, when you get putting in the Constitution that the enslaved would count as 3/5 of a human being, it race marks this nation, and I just want to get to that kind of sense of when I talked about aggrieved, and you said yes, and so African Americans say, yeah, you know, I'm doing better than my parents were. Also part of the sense of being aggrieved, mm-hmm. For whites is a misunderstanding of why the economic benefits aren't accruing the way that they used to. Mm-hmm. And so it is then a politicized search for a villain to explain it. And that politicized search for a villain, well, you know, you can't get into Berkeley because of all, you know, we've got that affirmative action and we've got to let in all of these unqualified minorities. Well, you know, you're not going to get that promotion because, you know, they're going to have to give it to a woman or to a minority. Well, you know, and so you get this kind of rhetoric that defines the reason why you don't get what you think you are entitled to is because of some woman or because of some minority. Instead of looking at part of what has happened to the ability to have a living wage is, one, the economy shifted from an industrial economy where you didn't have to have a college degree in order to make a living wage, and where we had really strong unions in the manufacturing sector. Those aren't where they were 50 years ago, where you didn't need a strong education, but now you do. But the ways that policies have worked to not fund state universities at the level where they should be funded in order that tuition is low enough so that people can actually afford to go to college, or the movement of Pell Grants over to making them into student loans with a narrative that actually, college is a personal investment and not a societal investment. Those types of policies have, in fact, closed off lots of opportunities. But instead, politically, it becomes those Mexicans, those immigrants, those blacks, those women.
Rage is clear, Carol, just on the faces of those demonstrators, white nationalist demonstrators screaming and wielding torches. But there's also this kind of cold and calculating white rage that you write about that can be easier to miss because it's couched as something different, right? Couched as housing policy or couched as government job cuts. Can you talk a little bit about the system that subtly creates and maintains an advantage for white people who literally may not recognize that it favors them?
Oh, absolutely. Ira Katznelson wrote a beautiful book called When Affirmative Action Was White. And he talks about, he particularly zeroes in on the time of the New Deal in the 1930s and then going a bit forward and looking at the kinds of policies that were created, such as the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration. And what FHA did, for instance, is prior to the Great Depression, when you went to buy a house, you had like a 5-year limit or 10-year limit to pay off that house, and you had to put a lot down. And so actually owning a home was for the wealthy. FHA spread that out over 30 years, allowed a much smaller down payment. And so you started getting the movement into making home ownership much more affordable. But FHA did something else too. FHA said, for us to underwrite this loan, we have to ensure that the property value is going to maintain. So we are not going to, and they started drawing red lines around blocks and neighborhoods. We are not going to rent, to provide loans in areas where African Americans live because housing values aren't that good. And we're not going to provide home loans to African Americans moving into white neighborhoods because then they're going to drive the property value down. What that meant then is that black people couldn't get loans because if I'm black and I'm trying to buy in a black neighborhood, I can't get an FHA loan. If I'm black and I'm trying to move into a white neighborhood, I can't get an FHA loan. And that pretty much was shut down by 1960. So the program had been in effect now for about 25 years, for a generation. And you've also got massive federal funding of suburbs by the 1950s. So by 1960, only about a little over 1% of all FHA loans, and that's over $1 billion, went to African Americans. The rest basically went to whites. A lot of the wealth that we see in America today was based on the restrictive funding coming out of the federal government for housing loans. That's a benefit that we don't often think of in terms of what that means in terms of differential. But we know where you live has a lot to do with the quality of your life.
All right, I want to go to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Savannah in Arkansas. Hi, Savannah. Hi, Savannah. Are you with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Hi. So I just had a quick question because a lot of people associate white supremacy with that kind of old Jim Crow or like what we saw in Charlottesville, the very loud, angry kind of thing. And I was just wondering maybe how people could maybe recognize more subtle or overt kind of white supremacy or racism and how to kind of combat that on a less angry, loud level that they may not recognize at first.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. And that's a lot of what I deal with in White Rage is how these policies, very cool, very calculated, very methodical, undermine African Americans' access to their civil rights, their human rights, and are put in place to roll back those achievements and those accomplishments. We see that, for instance, and I'll just take the election of Barack Obama. One of the major things that Barack Obama did was massive organizing in terms of voter registration and getting out the vote. In his election, millions of African Americans, Hispanics, and Asian Americans came out to vote in numbers that they had not done before. These were people who had not voted before, and now they saw a reason to be invested in this democracy. Our response as a nation has been to say that they committed massive voter fraud and to put in place an incredible electoral machinery to, in fact, erase them from the body politic so that they do not have a voice. And we do that, again, not by burning a cross, not by angry torches. We do that with very clean, clear, legalistic language that talks about, oh, well, you know, you need a voter ID. You know, we need to stop voter fraud. We need to protect the integrity of the ballot box. And so we just need to make sure that you are who you say you are when you're voting. So we'll need a government-issued photo ID. And then in the language that is written, only certain types of government-issued photo IDs qualify. And then, so let me take Alabama. Alabama's a good case. Alabama said you need to have a government-issued photo ID. And then Alabama said, ah, but public housing ID does not count. Now, excuse me, but public housing ID is a government-issued photo ID. But no, that doesn't count. You need to have particularly a driver's license. Now, about 20% of African Americans do not own a car. So there's no need to have a driver's license. But okay, a driver's license. So then what Alabama does is it shuts down the Department of Motor Vehicles where you can get a driver's license in the counties where many African Americans live, where they're called the Black Belt counties. So you require a driver's license. Then you shut down the place where you can get a driver's license. But say you need a driver's license in order to vote. So how we counter this is that we stay attuned to these kinds of policies that are being enacted supposedly in the name of democracy, but are the most undemocratic. And right now, what is happening in voter suppression across America requires our total vigilance, and that we are weighing in on our elected officials, because this is a way to game the system and to shut particularly African Americans and Latinos out of the political system.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Carol, is it going too far to say that the election of President Obama, to the extent that it was, if nothing else, a symbolic victory for people of color in this country, caused things to be worse in terms of white supremacy these years on?
Yeah, I hear that, and I'm just like, oh, Lord, I don't want to blame the man.
No, but I know it's a strange question to even phrase to you, but.
I know, because we hear that, but, you know, and I've said, Obama's presidency, in fact, unleashed this white rage in ways that have given us Donald Trump. A black man was in the White House, and a black man in the White House based on 15 million new voters coming to the polls in 2008. And many of those voters, I mean, 15 million new folk, and many of those voters being people of color. That was frightening, particularly to the Republican Party. I've got to say that, where I think it's like over 90% of their voters are white. And so you're seeing more and more people of color coming into the electorate. You're looking at your party and your party's policies, because you have skewed so far to the right, starting with the Southern Strategy in 1968 that wooed the solid Democratic South into the Republican Party by talking about curtailing black civil rights. And so you have started skewing so far to the right that many of your policies just don't resonate with the larger body politic. And so how do you win? And you win by either changing your policies, which they have refused to do, or by voter suppression, which is what they did.
Carol Anderson is chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University and author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Her essay in The Guardian yesterday is called America is Hooked on the Drug of White Supremacy. Carol, thank you so much for making time for us again. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate it as well.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. And I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.